Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This summer, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a trifecta of scary rulings on abortion, gun rights, and environmental protection. So far, the repeal of Roe v. Wade has drawn the most attention, but the other two rulings are equally concerning. Today, we talk with Lauren Goldberg, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about the court's decision on West Virginia versus the EPA, a ruling that limits the EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions in the power sector. And we'll discuss how it affects climate action here in the Northwest. Lauren, welcome back to Locus Focus.
So great to be here. Thank you.
I don't know that we were ever expecting to have a discussion that we're going to be having today about what would happen if the Supreme Court actually rolled back some of the regulatory power of the EPA. But we're doing a show today about one of the latest Supreme Court decisions, West Virginia versus the EPA. And I'm adding, and the rest of us. So I wanted, first of all, to get your sense as an environmental lawyer. What do you make of this decision?
It's a setback. It's a setback to the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to curb carbon pollution. So, you know, that said, the decision still leaves EPA with significant authority to use the same part of the Clean Air Act that it relied on in the decision to make power plants operate more cleanly. And so now the question is, will EPA be able to act swiftly at this critical time in the climate crisis to move ahead on the path that the Supreme Court has left open for the federal government to regulate very significant polluters?
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's at the core of this issue, because it was about a plan to limit the amount of carbon pollution that power plants could emit, but it was a plan that actually never was implemented. So let's talk a little bit about what that plan was and its kind of torturous journey to this current point.
Torturous is definitely the right word to describe how we ended up at this point. So just to, so we all get on the same page, let me make sure your listeners understand what the U.S. Supreme Court did earlier this summer. So in a 6-3 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA's authority to implement a key part of the Clean Air Act, a law, you know, the modern version passed in 1970, that it does not include directing power plants like coal-fired power plants, gas-fired power plants to shift from dirty sources of energy like coal to cleaner ones like wind and solar. And I'm going to talk a little bit more later about this sweeping new legal doctrine that the Supreme Court used for the first time, called the Major Questions Doctrine, that has major implications for both, you know, public health laws, environmental laws, and beyond. So the tortuous path. So Congress passed the Modern Clean Air Act back in 1970, and at that time, it charged this newly created agency, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, with fighting air pollution at the federal level. One part of the Clean Air Act specifically targets pollution from industrial sources like coal-fired power plants, and it explicitly authorizes EPA to define what's called the best system of emission reduction for each different industry. So power plants are the nation's largest industrial source of air pollution, including carbon emissions that are driving climate change. Now, in an attempt to reduce carbon pollution from coal and gas burning power plants, the Obama administration adopted the Clean Power Plan back in 2015. And under that plan, EPA determined that power companies could cut their air pollution through a combination of installing air pollution controls, called emission controls, and transitioning to cleaner forms of energy like wind and solar. So here's where the coal industry comes in. In response to that Obama rulemaking, coal companies, some parts of the power industry, and allied states sued. And in early 2016, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay, so basically putting on hold, preventing that clean power plan from ever taking effect. Now, here comes a fascinating twist. Even though the rule never went into effect, market forces and climate activism had already begun to drive a major transformation within the industry. So the power sector emissions actually fell so fast that they reached the EPA's 2030 goal more than a decade early in 2015. Nonetheless, Trump administration, not surprisingly, repealed the Clean Power Plan and adopted, in effect, a do-nothing rule, and that was overturned in federal court. So this was good because it opened the door for the Biden administration to take bold, swift action on the climate crisis. And in fact, EPA Administrator Michael Regan committed to writing a new rule. Again, enter the coal industry in conservative states, now led by West Virginia. They tried to block the rule before it was written. And this part of the story absolutely reminds me of when my kids come to me and say, we know you're going to say no, but can we blah, blah, blah. So that was exactly what the coal industry in these conservative states did. They went ahead and tried to block the rule before it was even written. So here, there was a wild ride of legal maneuvering that ultimately brought us to the U.S. Supreme Court. So big picture, what was the coal industry's strategy? They wanted a broad ruling from the highest court in the land that EPA can't use the Clean Air Act to tackle any significant new problem without going back to Congress each time for new and very detailed legislation. And what I found really fascinating is one analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council put it this way, you know, the coal industry is basically counting on lobbyists and dark money to keep Congress gridlocked so that those new laws are impossible to pass.
What was the outcome at the Supreme Court? What did that decision actually entail?
So the Clean Air Act still allows and requires EPA to regulate greenhouse gas pollution from the power sector. So sigh of relief there. But the court did curb EPA's options for limiting greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants. And it's a decision viewed by many, including myself, as one of the most important environmental decisions in years. It's a setback. The Supreme Court's decision is a setback for the Biden administration's efforts to combat climate change. So specifically, what the court ruled is that EPA does not have broad authority to shift the country's energy production away from coal-burning power plants toward cleaner sources, including wind and solar, under a specific section of the Clean Air Act. That ruling has really serious ramifications for federal agencies' ability to regulate polluters. But the court did not say that EPA lacks any authority to regulate emissions from existing power plants and vehicles. Instead, you know, the majority in the Supreme Court noted that for decades, the EPA, you know, has set what are called technology-based standards to make pollution sources operate more cleanly. So big picture, while the agency may not be able to tell power plant operators that they must shift from coal to renewables, EPA still can issue standards that would require individual facilities to install new pollution control measures. Bottom line, the decision leaves room for EPA to issue and enforce new standards for power plants that could increase efficiency and reduce emissions. And so that is, you know, really critical to remember at the end of the day as we are in the throes of the climate crisis.
It's been very obvious here for the last few weeks in Oregon and around the world. I think actually when I just saw some headlines about what's going on in Europe again with excessive heat, and I think we're getting off pretty easy. It's only 100 degrees in Portland. I'm not sure how hot it is in Hood River. I'm showing a little bit hotter than that maybe.
No, absolutely. As we feel the impacts of the climate crisis on a daily basis, it is absolutely imperative that the federal government take swift action to address what the U.S. Supreme Court has rolled back.
How much difficulty has this Supreme Court decision laid upon both the Biden administration and people in Congress who would like to actually address climate change head on? How much more difficult is it for them to move ahead with their agenda?
Well, this decision leaves authorities in place for EPA to act. And it also leaves in place authorities for states and local governments. So what has people that care about climate change and environmental and public protection so concerned about is this new legal doctrine that the court relied on called the Major Questions Doctrine, which, you know, we'll talk about more in a moment. And, you know, it's definitely this kind of the writing on the wall that it will become harder in the future to protect public health and combat the climate crisis with this new legal precedent that the Supreme Court's relying on. You know, but big picture, and we'll be talking about more, you know, there is incredible room for EPA to act swiftly and continue to combat the climate crisis, for Congress, as well as for states and local governments. And, you know, it is so important for EPA to be able to regulate power plants. The United States is the world's second largest carbon emitter, and its power sector accounts for about a quarter of those emissions. So again, what's so important now is for the Biden administration to act swiftly to use the authorities that still exist at EPA, both for existing power plants, but also for proposals for new power plants. And the White House has said that drafts of those of new rules will be released in March of 2023, but they need to move faster in the face of the climate crisis.
So what is this major questions doctrine you keep making references to?
Yes. So a quick note of context for those of you who didn't have to sit through administrative law. Congress frequently delegates, so hands over to agencies, the authority to regulate particular aspects of society in general or, you know, broad terms. But in a number of decisions, the Supreme Court has declared that if an agency wants to decide an issue of major national significance, its action must be supported by very clear statutory language, you know, by language that Congress put into law. So courts and commentators and individual Supreme Court justices have referred to this doctrine as the major questions doctrine or the major rules doctrine. Although, according to the Congressional Research Service, up until West Virginia v. EPA, the Supreme Court case we're talking about today, the court had never actually used that term in a majority opinion. So now, with West Virginia v. EPA, it marks the official arrival of the major questions doctrine in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. And that doctrine holds that the court should not defer to agencies, as it has been doing for four decades or more, if and when an agency appears to be doing something novel, and if that action, which is most often a regulation, might have quote-unquote vast economic and political significance. Now here's the question. Who gets to define what a major question is, or what an agency is permitted to do? Why? The justices themselves. So some commentators have described this doctrine as an unprecedented power grab by the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially allowing its more conservative justices to strike down any federal regulations they don't agree with. It's essentially a powerful deregulatory tool to advance an ideology of smaller government, rather than a clear aid to interpreting law. So there are, you know, tremendous concerns, and this is not just in the environmental community, but across the United States. You know, various sectors of our society, whether it's, you know, the food we eat, you know, health, etc. It really comes down to the rules, the regulations that these very large agencies adopt by interpreting federal law, and this. You know, West Virginia v. EPA, for many years, we're going to be looking at this case as a new line in the sand about how federal agencies get to interpret law.
Well, I got the impression from reading about the three most controversial Supreme Court decisions of this season, and besides the EPA decision, there's also, of course, Roe v. Wade, and then there's the gun control decision in New York State. I want to talk a little bit about how that has some creative ways of going around it. It seems like the Supreme Court is coming up with some very interesting doctrines that they're using, which I get the impression from articles that I'm reading are probably unconstitutional and also very bad law.
So it's not just a hunch among folks reading the news, reading recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. The court produced more conservative decisions this term than at any time since 1931, according to statistics compiled by professors Lee Epstein of Washington University in St. Louis and Kevin Quinn of the University of Michigan. And so it's not just a sense, it is a very much backed up by close analysis of the Supreme Court's history in almost a century. And so we are faced now with this reality of what can we do to combat the climate crisis in the face of this new decision? The answer, a lot. What can we do in other sectors? And, you know, what it does come down to is looking at the authorities that exist, whether at EPA or other agencies, but also looking at, you know, the way our country is structured, the authorities that states have and that local governments have to protect people's health and to combat the climate crisis.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Lauren Goldberg, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about the Supreme Court decision, West Virginia versus the EPA, a ruling that limits the EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions in the power sector. Right after the gun control decision came down that blocked New York State's very long time gun control, one of their gun control statutes, the state came back with a rewritten statute, and I'm not sure where it's at. But I wonder about ways that states can work around some of these edicts from the Supreme Court and find creative ways to get the agenda that they really believe, which is for the good of everybody, passed.
Right. States have tremendous authority to protect, you know, people's health and the environment and beyond. And what's so important to take away from this, you know, very disappointing Supreme Court decision is that the court has not and will not stop our ability, the state's ability, local government's ability, and quite frankly, you know, many federal agencies' ability to fight, you know, the fossil fuel industry and combat the climate crisis and win. And what I love to remind folks, because so many of your listeners have been part of these, you know, David versus Goliath fights to protect what they love, communities along the Columbia River and across the Pacific Northwest from an onslaught of fossil fuel infrastructure projects in the last decade plus. And the Supreme Court's decision does not unravel the 15 and counting fossil fuel infrastructure projects from, you know, massive liquefied natural gas terminals, the nation's largest coal export facilities, largest oil by rail terminals, hundreds of miles of frack gas pipelines and refineries that communities and tribal governments came together and defeated along the Columbia River and across the Pacific Northwest. The court's decision does not undo the climate legislation that Oregon and Washington adopted to tackle the climate crisis. You know, states and local governments continue to take action because people, tribal governments, you know, local governments have demanded action when the federal government's efforts on climate change have stalled out time and again. And so to me, a huge takeaway from this disappointing decision is the need to, you know, dig deep locally at the state level, at cities, counties, ports, you name it, to continue to take swift action to address the climate crisis.
I was listening to an interview I did with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute a year ago, and he was talking again about the thin green line and how he feels that the Pacific Northwest is really taking a leadership role in changing the whole concept of how we produce energy, how we consume energy, and how we fight the behemoth fossil fuel industries that are trying to dominate the world. And I was thinking about how, in fact, we've been doing this for so long without federal help that, in a way, this Supreme Court decision, as you're saying, doesn't really impact the work that we've been doing. But I wanted to kind of draw back on where we've been with fighting the fossil fuel industry in the Northwest here for now almost 20 years, and the lessons that we can learn to move forward and maybe actually change the conversation so even at the Supreme Court level it might be heard.
Absolutely. One of the first things I thought when I read the Supreme Court's decision was, thank goodness we shut down Oregon's only coal-fired power plant. And to be clear, you know, coal-fired power plants have huge impacts on climate change, huge local impacts. You know, we know from study after study that, you know, they disproportionately impact people of color. Here in Oregon, an incredible coalition came together in the early 2000s and set out to shut down Oregon's only coal-fired power plant, an incredibly dirty facility, you know, number one source of mercury pollution in the state. a potent neurotoxin. And it was through grassroots activism, as well as some very creative and strategic litigation that was spearheaded by the Environmental Law Clinic at Lewis and Clark Law School, Earthrise, that we were able to come together and shut down the PGE Boardman coal-fired power plant. And due to incredible activism in Washington state, there is, you know, one operating coal-fired power plant in Washington, but state law requires that that power plant shut down in 2025.
And that's the one in Centralia?
That's correct, in Centralia. And so there, it is true, you know, these federal regulations are absolutely critical to protecting public health and combating the climate crisis. But it, you know, at this time when the climate crisis is bearing down on us, to remember and to take action now on, you know, the existing sources of climate pollution and very harmful pollutants that impact people's health living near and in some, you know, cases far from these facilities, that there's so much that we can do right here at home in the face of, you know, as I said at the outset, a very disappointing decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Which brings me to asking your listeners, you know, right now to visit ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org. As you mentioned, I'm the executive director of Columbia River Keeper. And if you go to our website today, we have a petition, you right on our landing page, that folks can take action today to help stop a massive expansion of a gas pipeline in the Pacific Northwest. So that's just one example, and I'll speak more about it in a moment, but there's so much that we can do right now in the face of this very disappointing Supreme Court decision.
Well, one of the things that makes me think of is how many fossil fuel projects we've stopped, and we think at some point we stopped frack gas in Oregon, especially with stopping Jordan Cove LNG and stopping the Kalama methanol refinery. And then, of course, the one nobody ever knew about, the one at Port Westward along the Columbia River. So we think we're done with this, and then this new pipeline comes on our radar. So what does this say about the kind of vigilance that we need to maintain in order to be able to prevent the fossil fuel industry from, in its, I think, kind of death throes, still raising its Hydra head?
Hypervigilance is what it takes, hypervigilance. So, it really comes down to, tracking at the level of investor calls, industry publications, constant public records requests to, state agencies, ports, local governments, to make sure that we learn about these proposed fossil fuel, whether it's in right now, a lot of the focus is on expansion or new proposals, and that we also, develop quite frankly, some of the hardest work that we've been doing in recent years, which is strategies to shut down existing oil and gas infrastructure, because we simply cannot afford oil and gas infrastructure if we are going to combat the climate crisis. Now, the GTN gas pipeline expansion, which is actively happening right now in the Pacific Northwest, is a prime example of that hypervigilance. So TC Pipeline, which is the company that brought you Keystone XL Pipeline, this company proposes to add 250 million cubic feet per day of fracked gas capacity to its GTN pipeline. So the GTN pipeline is an existing gas pipeline running from Canada to California. And the amount of fracked gas that is proposed in the expansion is enough gas to serve about 1.2 million households each day. So we're talking about 1,300 miles of existing gas pipeline. And due to our region's tremendous success in defeating frack gas infrastructure, as well as other regions in the country, the fossil fuel industry has caught up to that and realized it's going to be very hard to site new fossil fuel infrastructure. And so instead, they're digging deep and looking at their existing infrastructure, like this existing 1,300-mile gas pipeline, and looking at ways to expand that infrastructure. So this project, which is called GTN Express, it's a major expansion of existing fossil fuel infrastructure, which our climate cannot afford. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, which, you know, folks will remember well from years of the liquefied natural gas, LNG terminal and pipeline fights, same agency is in the power seat. They have the authority to approve or deny the GTN Express pipeline expansion in late 2022 or 2023. And this is why we're asking, you know, your listeners to go to ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org and sign a petition today to FERC, because we only have until August 22nd to weigh in on that agency's draft environmental impact statement.
How much more difficult is it to stop the expansion of an existing project than it is to stop a new project?
It's significantly harder. You know, so we have turned the page in some instances. We are still fighting new proposals for new fossil fuel infrastructure along the Columbia and in the Pacific Northwest. But we've been very successful. We, as in, you know, tribal governments, communities, many nonprofits, you name it, in defeating proposals for massive new fossil fuel infrastructure. And now we are looking at these expansions of existing infrastructure, or in some cases, taking infrastructure that was once used for something else and then converting it, like Zenith Energy in Portland is a prime example. That was, if you know, at one point an asphalt facility that then, you know, what felt like overnight turned into an oil by rail, you know, tar sands facility. And it's really hard, Barbara. It's some of the hardest work that we're doing, and it's why we need continued support from people, you know, across the Northwest, supporting nonprofit organizations like Columbia Riverkeeper. And we need people to engage at the local level, sign petitions, and show up at public hearings when we're able to create these, you know, legal opportunities for the public to have another bite at the apple on what, you know, previous generations in some cases have approved. So, like, for example, this GTN gas pipeline, you know, some of the original infrastructure dates back to the 1960s. Well, now we have this opportunity to stop its expansion. It will be nearly impossible to meet Oregon's and Washington's greenhouse gas laws, which activists worked for years to pass, if this gas expansion happens. And just for those who love numbers, you know, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, calculated that the GTN Express pipeline could emit 3 million metric tons of greenhouse gas equivalent. So that would increase greenhouse gas emissions in Idaho by about 16%, in Washington by just under 4%, and in Oregon by almost 8% every year. So what's interesting is Washington and Oregon in just the last several years have passed laws that require decreasing emissions, you know, by 95% and 75% respectively by 2050. So it's deeply concerning that we have these kind of, you know, trying to fly under the radar proposals to expand fossil fuels in the Northwest at a time when it's clear that, you know, the public and elected officials are on a path through the laws adopted at the state level to get off fossil fuels.
Well, after Jordan Cove and FERC's response, which went ping-ponging back and forth depending who was president, it did seem that FERC had more promise as an agency that would actually regulate the fossil fuel industry, and they certainly kind of came out on the right side finally with Jordan Cove. But then I've heard about some FERC approvals to pipelines and other infrastructure for the fossil fuel industry back east. It sounds like the old rubber stamping. So I'm wondering if your sense is that FERC will just rubber stamp this pipeline expansion, or whether the new FERC we saw at Jordan Cove is going to raise its head instead.
It will take tremendous state leadership. So we're looking to Governor Inslee in Washington, Governor Brown in Oregon, climate champions in the, you know, state legislatures, you name it, to make it clear to FERC that the Pacific Northwest is on a different path, that we are not on a gas, frack gas expansion path. We are on a path to clean energy and bold action to combat the climate crisis. And so I think right now it's not about predicting the future. It's about rolling up our sleeves and working as hard as we can in the next several months to convince elected officials in FERC that frack gas expansion in the Pacific Northwest is absolutely inexcusable. It's not the path our region is on. And, you know, what that's going to take is flooding FERC with petitions. It's going to take bold leadership and statements from our elected officials. You know, it's at the highest levels of government, including the governors of Oregon and Washington, California. And where that leadership comes from is it's public pressure, it's activism. And so we really are at a critical time to, you know, the FERC under the Biden administration. There's no reason that FERC should not, you know, listen to these calls for bold action to combat the climate crisis. But it really is up to us right now to do that hard work. That said, we will preserve our rights at FERC to challenge any decision that the, you know, commission makes in court. So that, you know, like we did with LNG, like we did with coal export, oil, you name it, you know, we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket. We are going to work as hard as we can to convince FERC to, you know, to follow the law and protect public health, combat the climate crisis. But if FERC does capitulate to the fossil fuel industry, we'll be prepared to go to court.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUNN KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Lauren Goldberg, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about the Supreme Court decision, West Virginia versus the EPA, a ruling that limits the EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions in the power sector. Well, what you've been talking about with the GTN pipeline expansion is a good example of what we do without the help of the federal government actually and the EPA stepping in to regulate carbon emissions. But I'm wondering if you have some other examples of fights that you see down the pipeline that will also take this kind of local energy.
Absolutely. There's incredible momentum happening in cities, counties across the Pacific Northwest to take action now to break up with frack gas because we simply can't afford the climate impacts. The Portland Fossil Fuel Ordinance is, you know, one prime example that is, you know, back in the hands of the city this summer. So current regulations in Portland allow for unlimited growth of fossil fuel terminals, and the fossil fuel terminal zoning amendments that the city passed restrict the development of new fossil fuel storage tanks and the expansion of tank capacity at existing bulk fossil fuel terminals. That ordinance was the result of tremendous activism to convince, you know, the city to take action now to protect people's safety and combat the climate crisis. And, you know, of course, industry challenged it. The Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals is giving the city an opportunity to make some additional findings, and there is going to be a really important comment period coming up later this month. In Vancouver, Washington, you know, Vancouver has been focused on its own climate action plan. And in fact, earlier this summer, Vancouver's city council unanimously approved an amended version of the city's climate priority resolution. And that calls for adopting some of the most ambitious goals in the nation. So, you know, just for some examples, an 80% reduction in municipal operations greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. So these aggressive goals establish Vancouver, Washington as a national leader in tackling climate change. There's also been a huge momentum across cities and counties in Oregon and Washington to ban frack gas in new buildings that, for example, recently passed in Eugene, Oregon. What we are also turning to, as we discussed earlier, is looking at existing oil and gas infrastructure, and that remains a major challenge to combat the climate crisis at the same time that we have existing oil and gas infrastructure that in some cases can really ramp up production in greenhouse gas pollution. So we are continuing at Columbia Riverkeeper to work with our partners stop the Zenith Oil by Rail terminal in Portland from handling oil. We had a tremendous victory when the city of Portland rejected Zenith's oil operations. Again, not surprisingly, the oil company challenged that in court. And right now we're waiting for a decision from the Oregon Supreme Court before the city can take final action. Another example is the Cardi gas-fired power plant near Boardman, Oregon. So in Oregon, you know, we do rely, we have a number of natural gas-fired power plants in our state, and an industry, for example, in this case, you know, PGE has in some cases asked to increase pollution from their gas-fired power plants. There was a tremendous amount of activism that played out in 2021, and right now we are anxiously awaiting a decision from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality on whether, you know, the state agency is going to rubber stamp PGE's request to increase dangerous air pollution from that gas-fired power plant.
I find that ironic, since PGE tries to present itself as a climate champion. And when you look at PGE versus Northwest Natural Gas, PGE looks so much better. But the reality of it is they must be in cahoots on some level.
Yeah, the reality is that, you know, we have these existing gas-fired power plants in Oregon, and to really get to that 100% carbon-free grid, it's going to take moving to renewables. What is important to highlight is that in Oregon, a critical law was passed, HB 2021, that, you know, sets this target to achieve 100% carbon-free electricity sold in the state. Currently, there's at least 17 other states in the districts of Columbia that have adopted similar goals. But one thing to highlight there, as we talk about natural gas-fired power plants, is that HB 2021 effectively bans new or repowered fossil fuel electric generation plants, including those powered by natural gas. So there has been really important steps taken by the Oregon legislature to, when I first was coming into the environmental movement, you know, natural gas, as it was called, now, you know, lots of folks are calling it methane gas or frack gas, you name it, that really tries to undo that, you know, very deceitful branding. But all that to say, you know, for many years, it was thought of as this bridge fuel. And it's really clear that, you know, here in the Pacific Northwest, our policymakers, and the public have moved beyond that moniker.
Well, you mentioned that the fate of Zenith Energy that snuck in a few years ago and started importing and then exporting tar sands and Bakken oil, that their appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court, I think a lot of people figure the Oregon Supreme Court will probably deny their appeal. Our worst case scenario, though, is what happens if they appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court?
There's definitely some limits on what cases can reach the Supreme Court, and we are hopeful that in the case of the Zenith oil terminal that ultimately and hopefully in short measure, the decision will be back in front of the city of Portland, and that we can, you know, move on a path of protecting people that live near the rail lines that are impacted by the oil train traffic that, you know, services Zenith, as well as the people, you know, living near the facility. And quite frankly, you know, the more oil handled on, you know, the Columbia, the Willamette, you know, the greater risk it is to these incredible ecosystems and, you know, clean water. And so it is unfortunate that we need to now wait on the Oregon Supreme Court for a ruling, but the rulings from the lower courts, the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals, the Oregon Court of Appeals, which, you know, approved what LUBA had ruled, you know, give us a lot of hope that we are on a solid path to protecting people and our climate from Zenith.
Well, people might wonder, since Portland has been touted with having this visionary fossil fuel infrastructure, a future fossil fuel infrastructure ban that went into effect, or it was passed in 2016, actually right after Trump was elected president, ironically. But it doesn't seem to have taken effect, and that's how Zenith was able to sneak in. So what do we do about the incredible lag that it's taken for even this pioneering ordinance to actually become effective?
I think this is where it's absolutely critical to look across the board at all of the different ways that we can be combating the climate crisis in the Pacific Northwest. You know, it's not just at one facility. It's not just with one law. It's not just with one ordinance. It's really looking across the board. And this is where, you know, the climate movement across the Northwest has gained so much momentum. And, you know, the last decade plus, as we, you know, came together to fight the onslaught of, you know, fossil fuel facilities and move new policies at the state level, at the local level. And it really, you know, the reality is we are working within the rule of law, within, you know, the within the court systems, and which often move at a very sluggish pace. And this is where, you know, for folks that live near these facilities, that is a completely unsatisfactory answer that we've, you know, set up as a society. But, you know, nonetheless, from the standpoint of how do we combat the climate crisis, how do we keep, you know, pushing progress, it really takes an approach of looking at every level, you know, taking on, you know, whether it's oil or gas or coal, and being, you know, really vigilant, and then seeing it through, and for the public to stay committed to these fights for the long haul. I mean, we learned that through the LNG proposals, both along the Columbia and the Southern Oregon coast. You know, if folks had tired of those and moved on to the next shiny object, we never would have defeated these multi-billion dollar LNG terminals and hundreds of miles of frack gas pipeline. It really takes that long-term commitment to see through to the ultimate victory.
Well, speaking about long-term commitments, there's a lot of focus on Portland's critical energy infrastructure hub, that massive expanse of tank farms filled with all kinds of really dangerous things. And you're talking about the need to dismantle fossil fuel infrastructure. That's the next step that we need to be taking. How do you see going about dismantling that? I mean, there's a lot of discussion. There's the issue around the economic opportunity assessment that's going through the state land use planning process that Portland has to write, and there's debates about how the issues around the CEI hub should be factored into what kinds of decisions are made about expanding or not expanding industrial development there. So what's your thoughts about taking on that behemoth?
Yeah, no, it's an incredible, you know, grassroots-led effort to address, you know, long, again, this is, you know, infrastructure that went in long before, you know, many folks were, you know, involved in climate activism, or even
born
exactly, or, you know, had moved to the area. And it really is a tremendous grassroots effort. And I think it, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to take some real leadership from state legislators and from the city to ensure that this this infrastructure that's in some of the most, you know, dangerous part of Portland from the standpoint of earthquake risk is addressed, and that there is a glide path to, you know, both, you know, protecting people and clean water, you know, as well as, you know, moving off of, you know, our fossil fuel reliant infrastructure in the city.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on Cambria Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Lauren Goldberg, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, about the Supreme Court decision, West Virginia v. EPA, a ruling that limits the EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions in the power sector. And we're talking about what we can do, despite that decision, to keep working on limiting all kinds of carbon emissions and other noxious emissions here in the Northwest. You were talking before about the Biden administration needing to basically kick into gear to come up with new rules that would actually fulfill the requirements that the Supreme Court is giving them for giving the EPA more regulatory power. I'm wondering what you see that the Biden administration needs to do, and how perhaps the new the legislation that is just about to be passed by the House, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, how that would perhaps be a way to move ahead.
Absolutely. So what's important now is for the Biden administration to act swiftly, to use the authority that EPA has. And the two most obvious rules for EPA to pursue are, you know, direct regulation of greenhouse gases from existing power plants and new power plants. The IRA is a really important step to, you know, address the climate crisis. And there, you know, it is a massive piece of legislation, and it is, you know, absolutely critical, and will, you know, it will time will tell how swiftly the, you know, EPA can act, and the extent to which the guidance that the court has, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has provided in its recent decision, West Virginia v. EPA, the extent to which courts moving forward will try to thwart both EPA and other agencies' authority. And again, this gets to the importance of repetition. To really get at the climate crisis. You know, we need EPA acting. We also need to see the states continue to pursue, you know, the full suite of options that exist to address the climate crisis. You know, a great example here in Oregon is recently the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality adopted new rules, the Climate Protection Plan, which, you know, came out of an executive order from Governor Brown. You know, but there's a loophole in those rules as they apply to existing gas-fired power plants in Oregon. So really being vigilant to both address some of the, you know, the biggest, most sweeping actions that we can at the federal level with EPA's existing authority, but to also make sure that we're plugging the holes, the loopholes that exist at the state level, as well as the local level. And so that's where, you know, it's critical not to overlook the need to address new proposals for, you know, from fossil fuel companies, but also these really sneaky efforts from the fossil fuel industry to expand or convert existing energy infrastructure.
Another concern has to do with the natural gas industry. And here in Portland, it's Northwest Natural Gas, and up in the Puget Sound area, it's Puget Sound Energy, that they have this kind of very sneaky way of presenting themselves like a green alternative. And so with Northwest Natural Gas, the latest is renewable natural gas, which doesn't really exist on the scale that they're talking about. And then, of course, hydrogen. And they're calling it green hydrogen, but there's also a lot of other kinds of hydrogen. So I wonder, how do we factor that in, that we are at the same time trying to get better regulations and working on a governmental level, but also having to deal with the incredible lobbying and propaganda efforts on the part of the natural gas industry?
The propaganda is tremendous, and it's, you know, many have, you know, compared it to the tobacco industry. And I think this is where we're fortunate in the Pacific Northwest to have incredible think tanks like, you know, the Sightline Institute, Green Energy Institute out of Lewis and Clark Law School, and, you know, really amazing advocacy organizations that are trusted resources to understand the propaganda and to unpack the propaganda and to make sure that, especially when it comes to legislators, whether, you know, at the state level or the local level, that there's clarity around what whether, you know, the shiny new thing is actually everything that it promises. You know, an example of a facility along the Columbia River that some of your listeners might have heard of is this Next Renewable Fuels proposal. So this company, Next, is seeking to build this new, very large renewable diesel refinery in the Columbia River estuary. It's in an area that's, you know, surrounded by, you know, some of the multi-billion dollar investment that's been made in restoring endangered salmon habitat and clean water in the Columbia River estuary. And renewable diesel requires more refining than biodiesel. And it also happens to be a form of biofuel that's more easily used to replace diesel than conventional biodiesel.
What is renewable diesel?
Well, what's important to keep in mind is that the process to convert these feedstocks into diesel fuel, it demands a lot of power, frack gas, and water. So it's a very energy intensive process, including using a significant amount of frack gas. So this specific project would produce around 50,000 barrels per day of renewable diesel and other fuels. But again, kind of looking deeper below the surface at, there's a fossil fuel involved here, and it happens to be frack gas. So, you know, I think this is where it will be more important than ever, in the same way that it was when natural gas was introduced as this solution to the climate crisis, to be skeptics and to do our research to understand, you know, what are the full climate impacts of proposed alternatives.
One of the things I read after the Supreme Court decision about the EPA was that eventually the Supreme Court changes as public opinion becomes more and more vociferous. And you think about there's been some other really bad Supreme Court decisions in the past that upheld separate but equal and upheld actually that blacks were not human beings and things like that. So I wonder, in looking in the long run, could you see what kind of movement would it take to get at least a couple of those six votes on this current Supreme Court to rethink the positions they're in if they see that, in fact, they're really out of step with the public?
I'm not a U.S. Supreme Court expert, but I do love listening to those that are. And I think it's, you know, this is one of those I know myself and many in the environmental community, we love to share stories of hope, of inspiration. And I think, you know, with the super majority of conservatives on the Supreme Court, it's a time to be deeply troubled, scared, you name it. And I think it's also a time to, you know, look big picture. You know, the number of decisions that make it to the Supreme Court are a fraction of the, you know, lawsuits, and a very small fraction of the lawsuits in the country. The extent to which there are tremendous laws currently on the books, you know, whether it's the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, you name it, where we, you know, the federal agencies have a lot of authority to protect people's health and our climate. And then also looking at the state level and, you know, the roles that state legislatures and agencies and, you know, local governments, whether it's the city of Portland or city of Vancouver, can take to address public health, environmental injustices, and the climate crisis. And so I think that looking specifically at the Supreme Court, I'm not here today to offer any tale of hope.
I'm just thinking, while we're talking, it's just the day after Donald Trump had his house searched by the FBI, and maybe there's a turn of things. I'm not sure. I've talked to a few people today who are like really optimistic that maybe some of this really intense horror that we've been perceiving as we watch democracy is worse than eroding. It seems like it's unraveling in so many factors. So kind of as a final thought, how do we save democracy? And do you see that there's hope in some of the institutions that we already have?
Well, in my, you know, 14 plus years of working at Columbia River Keeper, I have every reason to, you know, believe in hope and to believe in the power of our democracy and the power of people coming together to protect what they love. You know, time and again, we've been able to come together and celebrate what, you know, initially were, you know, unthinkable victories over some of the biggest fossil fuel companies on Earth. And to see the power of individuals and, you know, working within our democratic system. So I do see the, reason to believe that if we don't give up on our democracy, I don't think there's, you know, for me, you know, speaking on a personal level, there's no choice. This is a time when we need to dig as deep as we can to, you know, protect and ensure our democracy thrives. And I think that here in, you know, communities along the Columbia, there are, you know, tremendous opportunities and reason for hope and celebration in the face of really, you know, disappointing actions from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, Lauren, first of all, I want to thank your organization, Columbia River Keeper, because I think that your group is one of the ones really in the forefront of saving us from the worst things that could happen to this region and to the world. And also want to congratulate you on your new position as executive director. Thanks very much for being on Locus Focus today, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. It's always a real honor to get to speak with you, Barbara. Thank you.
We've been talking with Lauren Goldberg, Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, K KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk again about the proposed Portland City Charter changes that will be on the November ballot, this time with former Portland City Attorney Stephen Moskowitz. We'll go out with music by Hamza Aldeen. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary. Sinakir mas tuh.